friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. Either way, that's spelled speculist.com. On the blog and here on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about the future. And in fact, we're not afraid to give you a straight scoop about the future. And that straight scoop, is that our world is not going to hell in a handbasket, and it's not going to hell by any other means, but is in fact getting better all the time. And not only that, but that we stand on the brink of an incredibly bright future, if we play our cards right, a future that most of us haven't even imagined, much less dared hope for. Well, my name is Phil Bauermaster, having a little trouble articulating this evening, but with me, as always, is my co-host, co-blogger, and co-futurist, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. Hey, man, you're getting better all the time, though. Don't worry about that. Yeah.
Well, I'm super fantastic in any case.
Yeah, that's right. Man, did you get to see the Indiana Jones movie this weekend?
You know, I went to see that last night, as a matter of fact.
Man,
how about
you? I did, and I had a good time. Took the kids, and even the youngest was, you know, on the edge of his seat. You know, we had a real good time. That was fun. Old Indy, you know, got it together for one good adventure here. Probably his last one, I would imagine.
I would have thought the previous one would have been the last one. I'm going to say this is definitely the end. I don't think they're going to make any more Indiana Jones movies. I think they finished.
Yeah. But, I mean, but this one was enjoyable. I assume you enjoyed it as well. I mean, I don't want to give
away
too much about the plot or anything, but it was...
I liked about the first hour, and it kind of lost me. We got into the jungle, and I was just like, you know, I think Spielberg's kind of phoning it in here just a little bit. I don't know if it's really a problem with the movie or if it's what Tobias Buckel was telling us, was advising me about the... reviewing the Planet of the Apes movies. He gave those great words of wisdom, you can't go home again. And I think I think there might be a little of that with Indiana Jones. It could be just that the expectations get set so high, and then you watch it and you go, well, yeah, it was pretty good. I don't know. It certainly enjoyed some of the topics that they had Indy dealing with. Without spoiling anything at all, I will say that as one critic put it, as Spielberg was reaching out to other portions of his canon in telling this particular story. I think you can say that without giving too much away.
That's right, and I think he was doing exactly that. But I think there was evidence to me that there was a lot of development hell going on in the making of this. It seemed like there was some tonal weirdness, like, you know, as if it was written by different people, and then
I think that's
put together like
observation.
It felt like it was put together like a quilt, instead of a single tight package like Raiders was. And I mean, but you know what? I've enjoyed all the Indiana Jones movies. Raiders, of course, is probably one of the best action movies ever. And then none of equal Raiders, but it's hard to do that. I mean, you know, when you make the best action movie ever, you're in any sequel is not going to be as good. But each sequel has something to say for it and to recommend it. And I've watched all the sequels, you know, now and have enjoyed every one of them and more than once on Tomb and Last Crusade and. What's the other one?
Temple of Doom.
Temple of Doom. There you go.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed those more than once. And Raiders, of course, I watch all the time. But what makes me mad as an Indiana Jones fan is that Harrison Ford basically said 19 years ago when he made Last Crusade that I'm getting too old for this and stopped. And then, like, 19 years passes, and then they bring us another Indiana Jones movie, which was pretty good. It wasn't terrible. And I'm thinking, 19 years, you know, if they'd have brought us one every 3 years or so, we could have had six more Indiana Jones movies, and it would have been, in that period of time that they would have covered, would have included World War II. And
there you go.
So, anyway, it seems like a lost opportunity to have had a really cool World War II Indiana Jones adventure, but oh well.
That's an interesting thought. I have to say, I love the way they covered World War II, though. Their explanation of what Indy was doing during World War II, I found very satisfying and seemed exactly right.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind seeing a movie about that. That would be pretty awesome. But,
they'd have to recast it, of course, bring in somebody that could, you know, play Indiana Jones at the right age. And yeah, it would be a great movie, I think. It's basically claiming for Indiana Jones the status of a member of the greatest generation, you know.
Yes.
Reminding
us that he's a member of that generation, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I never thought of him as quite as heroic as when he delivers a line. Okay, spoiler coming, so give yourself 10 seconds. Here you go. I like Ike. When Indy says that line, I'm just so impressed by him. I'm thinking, man, that's telling him, pal. That was a good
yeah.
line. But let's not dwell on the Indiana Jones movie, because actually I want to come back to it. I'd like us to talk about it further. I've got kind of a philosophical issue, perhaps, with the movie, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on it this evening because we've got some other topics that we want to get into, and also it would definitely require spoiling the plot. So since not everyone's had a chance to see it yet, we'll come back and talk about my philosophical issues with Indiana Jones and the King.
Maybe we can hit it at the end of the summer or something, and then have a big spoiler filled discussion about it or something. When everybody's had a chance
exactly.
to watch it. Yeah.
And when everybody's had a chance to see it, so we're not giving too much away like I did with that one line. But Kate Blanchett was great, I thought, by the way, just before we...
She played a great heavy. I don't think that gives anything away. You can see that in the very beginning. But anyway, yeah, she's...
Yeah, and if they ever make another Rocky and Bullwinkle movie, she can play Natasha. There's no
doubt, no doubt.
She's all over it, man. So anyhow... But we do have several things we want to get into. I didn't mention up front that our topic this evening is time travel, and we're going to get into that. Before that, we're going to take a detour.
You
and
need
talk
to go
about
back it. In time and mention that at the very beginning of the show, Phil.
Oh, see, if only we could. Actually, we could edit it to make that change. But before we get into time travel, we're going to talk a little bit of space travel. But before we talk a little bit of space travel, I just want to note, and you actually made the perfect segue for it by mentioning that Indy was a member of the Greatest Generation, that this is, in fact, Memorial Day weekend.
That's
and
right.
We want to make note of that and express our gratitude to all those who have made that ultimate sacrifice in service of our country, and also just those who are veterans and who haven't made that sacrifice. In fact, our chat host is MIA this evening, but Michael Darling, I wanted to mention, which I've never mentioned on the show before, was actually a combat veteran of the first Iraq War. And
right.
So, Michael, wherever you are, thank you for your service. We appreciate it. And to all those listening who are veterans or active duty or family of same, thank you all very much for your service.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Now, on to space travel. Big news, this is almost like real-time news. This is almost like breaking news when we get to report something like this. Ladies and gentlemen, the Phoenix has landed.
This is such breaking news, I'm not aware of it, Phil, so you're going to have to educate me. What has happened?
Okay, well, I'll just read a bit here. The spacecraft Phoenix landed successfully today on the icy northern plains of Mars after a triumphant voyage of 422 million miles halfway around the sun. With a 130-pound cargo of instruments and a robotic digging arm to probe for ancient water and ice and long-decayed traces of organic chemicals essential for life, the lander's three legs settled gently onto a rock-free Martian surface at precisely 4:38 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So that would have been... a couple hours ago, about 2.5 hours ago. This is a huge mission. For one thing, it's nice to see that we've got another successful landing on Mars. We've had a little bit of trouble with that in the past without getting into any of the gory details on that. Actually, the article mentions that in this era of Martian exploration, only five other spacecraft have landed successfully, two Vikings, one Pathfinder with its mini rover Sojourner, and two rovers, the famed Opportunity and the Spirit, which are still roaming the planet after 4 years after their arrival. Now
the real Energizer bunnies, aren't they?
Well, they are. They're amazing craft. Now Phoenix is there, and Phoenix has a very special mission. It has been sent to the poles, and I actually got an email probably last night, I think, from a member of the Boulder Futures Salon who said, "Everyone, be on the lookout. Be thinking about the Phoenix as it makes this approach," because they were using reverse thrusters. They were using a kind of approach that has not been terribly successful for these kinds of landings, but it was necessary in order to make this polar landing. So there was a good deal of tension as to, how successful would this be? Was the thing going to land? And it has landed. And now Phoenix is going to be looking at polar ice on Mars. We're going to, hopefully, if it landed in the right place, for the first time, be able to actually see what the contents of Martian water is, and whether that gives us any evidence one way or another as to present or probably more likely ancient life on the planet.
That's very neat, very neat. And the ice at the poles on Mars, that is water ice? Or is
it
something
is,
else?
Yes.
Water ice.
There was a time back in the day when there was speculation, was that water or was that dry ice? Was that frozen CO2? But there may be some frozen CO2 around on the surface of the planet, but there definitely is, has been confirmed, there definitely is H2O in ice form on the surface of Mars around the poles. So hopefully that's what it's landed near, some of that.
Well, that's very important to any potential human mission to Mars, isn't it, that there is water available? Very cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If that water can be used, if you can land a spaceship near it, and if you can access it, thaw it out, then you have the, depending on what the nature of the mission is, once you're talking about a manned mission to Mars, you have the potential to drink the water, right? And thus not have to carry all that water to the planet. But if you're looking at doing things like more ambitious lands, like raising food there, then you've got water that you can grow food with, et cetera. So, yeah, water on Mars is a big deal for
oxygen. It's an oxygen source. It's an energy source. The hydrogen.
Yeah.
It's the big thing that would make actually living there possible. So yeah, very cool.
Yeah, this is a big deal, and it's the thing that'll probably give us the best clue yet as to whether there's any life there or whether there has been any life there, because they can, if they can thaw out a few drops of Martian water, and if you got frozen amoebas in there, wow, that'll be pretty exciting. On the other hand, there might just be chemical composition in the water that would indicate that there has been life, or that there may currently be life. So it's very exciting moment here for NASA, and we're looking forward to hearing a lot more about the Phoenix.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's get into time travel a little bit, Phil. That's that was our stated mission for this show, is to talk a little bit about time travel.
We are all about the time travel tonight. I tell you what, before we delve in, let me just say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Stephen Gordon and Phil Bauermaster talking now about time travel. If you've got some thoughts, would like to share with us, give us a call at 347-215-8972 or join us in the chat room. Yeah, go ahead, Stephen.
All right. Well, a scientist who's a physicist by the name of, is it Ronald Mallet or Mallet or?
I've been reading it mallet, but that's probably too easy.
It might be as simple as mallet. We'll go with that. He is one of several, apparently, physicists that are coming out of the closet on the whole issue of whether, it's possible to construct some kind of time machine. And his motivation is almost as interesting as the possibility of time travel.
Absolutely.
You want to get into that a little bit?
It would make a great story. If you were writing a science fiction story about somebody who wanted to build a time machine, this would be the kind of motivation that you might give a character. And basically, as a child or a young man, Dr. Mallet lost his father to a heart attack, was sent into depression because of that loss. And I it seems to me I've read elsewhere he also lost his mother. I think he's lost both of his parents. Came upon the idea of, and became kind of obsessed with the idea of building a time machine, which was his way of dealing with his grief. It was his hope as a young person that, well, I'll build a time machine and I'll go back and, you know, see my dad again or fix things or, you know, whatever the thinking was in the young mind. That actually inspired him to go on, become a physicist, and now, become really probably the leading voice in those who are coming forward and saying, yes, there is something to this. The time travel might actually be something that we can achieve.
And it's interesting that he's not getting a lot of people that are coming out and saying, you know, time travel is absolutely impossible. Apparently, from what we understand, most physicists will say that, you know, it's a possibility. There's nothing in what we understand and know now that would prohibit it. And Stephen Hawking is actually excited about the possibility of the study of it, and he thinks that it would be as important to learn why it's not possible as it would be to learn that it is possible. So by studying it, we can either eliminate it as a possibility, and then that would, and by doing so, understand the universe to a greater extent, or we'd learn how to do it. And either way, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, either way, it is very interesting. The thing about Hawking is he has made statements that both sound like he is accepting the possibility of time travel and the statements that sound like he's completely rejecting it. So he's been a little bit enigmatic on this particular subject as he is on some subjects. But you're right when you say that it's not specifically mathematically excluded by the laws of physics, at least by the way most scientists understand general relativity, special relativity, even some of the more exotic, string theory and some of the other formulations of how the universe works. Time travel is there's nothing that says this can't happen. Now there are huge barriers. You know, that's not to say that there aren't big barriers. And let's talk. Let's divvy the topic of time travel up, because there are actually more hopeful and less hopeful areas of possible ways of traveling through time. And I think the one that probably gets people's attention the quickest is if you think about traveling into the past. Time travel into the past is, again, not excluded by the laws of physics, but it would take
exotic solution, wouldn't it?
It would take an exotic solution. Thank you. That's what I was struggling to. That was the phrase I was struggling for. For example, one example is that if you travel faster than light, then there are certain frames of reference from which you will appear to be moving backward through time. Okay, so
right.
So that one's like, okay, so if you want to go back in time, all you got to do is go faster than light. It's kind of like the old Steve Martin, you can be a millionaire and never pay income tax, right?
Yeah,
first
$1 million.
Yeah, get $1 million. Yeah, you know, I mean, that first step is a doozy, okay? Going faster than light is not something that we have any clear idea how we could ever do it. That is something that seems to be, if not absolutely prohibited, almost absolutely prohibited, put it that way. You would need, if you were going to do it, say, with a rocket, okay, just a regular rocket, you're not warp drive or any fun stuff like that, it would actually take, I think, infinite energy to move any mass to the speed of light. And since that seems like more energy than any of us is likely to have access to, it's going to be hard to travel back through time. But then there are other possibilities, and Mallet talks about these, that there are exotic structures, there are wormholes. There's the fact that any massive object actually warps, actually changes the fabric of space-time. And his research is around using energy to replicate the effect that mass has on space-time. And
he uses high-energy lasers, doesn't he?
Exactly.
He's working on a tabletop experiment where he uses lasers to warp space the same way a massive object warps space. And his idea is to warp it enough to where you warp it all the way back around and basically have space where you could send particles in sort of a time loop. That's an interesting thing. Several physicists have looked at this. We think it would work, but you would need something your experiment would need to have the radius of the universe in order to. You would need a loop.
Right. Back there, you need infinite energy or the radius of the universe. You know, I mean, it's a tough nut to crack, apparently.
Yeah, apparently so. But he's going to give it a shot, and you know what I love about the whole deal is his coming out of the closet about it. I think so much science is advanced when scientists are they leave their fear of being labeled as crazy behind them. You have people like Aubrey de Grey that come out about life extension, and then all these there's so many areas like, for example, nanotech and things like that, where the ideas sounded crazy just a few years ago, and now they're becoming mainstream science.
Absolutely right. I mean, when Kurt
Dr. Millett, we appreciate your courage not to give up, trying these things for fear of being labeled crazy. It's the crazy guys that make it happen, as far as I'm concerned.
The crazy guys make things happen, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I've read by him is that one of the kind of unfortunate limitations to time travel as he conceives it, and he does think he expects eventually to build a time machine that will work. And by a time machine that will work, I mean a device that can actually send a human being back in time. That would be the kind of working definition from his reference.
Wow, that's a long way from sending particles back a fraction of a second.
Which is what he's trying to do now. Exactly.
Yeah, that's a huge step from there to sending a human being back in time to see your dad or something. That's a big deal.
Well, in fact, you just caught the. With your qualifier there, you just caught the rub, because even Mallet says that the trouble with the time machine once it's built is it won't be able to go back in time any further than the day it was built.
Well, that's interesting.
So he doesn't foresee any means of building a time machine that would enable him to go back and see his father. He has abandoned that idea, although he continues to pursue time travel as his passion. But,
well, you know, that would explain why we're not getting visitors from the future.
We don't have a time machine yet.
We don't have a time machine yet. Maybe the day we invent a time machine, all of a sudden we'll have visitors from the future all of a sudden. That would be interesting.
Because then they can show up.
Yeah.
Until there's a time machine, no one can travel back to here to get to it. So, it's one of those weird, it can almost make your head hurt a little bit thinking about it, but that could very well be the reason that we don't experience time travel.
I've
never met a time traveler.
The whole issue of time travel, I came across this little idea when here I was as a 12-year-old thinking about time travel. Okay, this is a kid's idea of a problem that might come up for time travelers. The Earth moves through space at a very fast rate, right? So if I travel back, and so let's say I'm here now in this place, in this spot where the Earth is right now, and I travel back in time, I'm in outer space because the Earth is somewhere else. You'd have to.
Oh, that's a good point.
You'd have to track the movement of the Earth as well as time. You know, I mean, anyway, I don't know. That might be a bit of a problem for potential time travelers as well.
Well, you got to think about that. But I don't know. Would you still be gravitationally in place You think about, did you ever see the movie Time After Time? Luckily, we have movies to explain how all these things work for us. But,
That's right. I love that movie.
Yeah, H.G. Wells invents a time machine. He goes into the future, and while he's traveling into the future, his mock-up replica time machine that he built makes its way from London to San Francisco. So when he arrives in the future, he's in San Francisco because the machine has been moved from one location to the other. So it's kind of in line with what you were talking about. He didn't end up where he started. He would have expected to arrive in London in the future, and instead he ended up in San Francisco in the future because the time machine had been moved while he was in it, traveling to the future.
Interesting.
But at least he didn't end up where London was out in space, 150 years or 100 years ago or something like that. He would have really been hosed.
Yeah, no doubt. We haven't even gotten into the grandfather paradox and all the other problems that, like meeting yourself in the future or in the past or something like that.
Before we talk paradox, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Why travel back in time? What are the practical, because we've praised Mallet now for working on this, but what good does it do to travel back through time? What would the benefits be of traveling back through time? Can you think of any?
I don't know. Go back in time and place a bet on something. I don't know.
Okay.
Personal historical, you get a real historical view of things. You could go back and see major events in our history and understand history in ways that historians would and archaeologists can only dream about. I guess that would be one reason to travel back in time. But
I think that's a good one. Yeah.
But I guess that's about it. Meeting your ancestors or whatever, it'd be interesting.
Yeah, I think if the goal is to go back and get information on the past, then that's worthwhile. I think that a lot of times, and certainly good fiction about time travel, the premise is you're going to go back and change something. And
yeah.
as soon as you get that idea, well, I'm going to go back in time, and effectively, if you go back in time and even place the bets, right, or make the investments, you have changed something. Also, you'll be rich, right, when you get back to the future because you made those really smart bets back in the past. But
right.
that's kind of the driving narrative for time travel. If you're going to tell a time travel story, it's got to be about doing something different. You're going to go back and change the way things were. There was a great spoof of how Wikipedia editing works that made the rounds a few weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it, and it had to do with they weren't running Wikipedia; they were running this time travel organization. And everybody who joined is like the first day they'd always go back in time and kill Hitler.
Yeah.
And then somebody else would have to step in and explain why it doesn't work to go back and kill Hitler, and we're not allowed to do that, and don't go back and kill Hitler. But that's the other big motivator, right? Go back in time, kill Hitler, you stop World War II from happening, or go back in time and settle some score, or keep some bad thing, or undo some stupid mistake that you made in the past.
There was a movie. Speaking of movies that solve everything, you remember the movie where they went back in time and they had the opportunity to keep Pearl Harbor from happening, and then they decided
the final countdown.
Yeah. It was sort of a letdown. I mean, the whole movie was, well, we could stop it, but then they don't. So it's a movie about doing nothing. But at any rate,
there is one great scene where the were they F-15s? Is that right? Off an aircraft carrier? Yeah, F-15s are just trying to fly slow enough to stay behind those Japanese Zeros. Right. I love that scene.
They're just
like,
about to stall out. Yeah.
and there is a couple of the Japanese planes do get shot down because I remember there's that line, splash the Zeros, and it's just like boom, and they're down. There was just one aircraft carrier from what was that, late 70s?
Oh, yeah. Obviously, yeah, it would have.
And we'd have had a real shot at winning the Battle of Pearl Harbor, right? I mean,
that's right.
Probably would have.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's yeah. It's a great premise, and nothing happens because they don't want to. You don't want to do what you were talking about, which is mess with time, mess with the line of time, create some kind of a paradox. Let's get into the paradoxes, but before we do, let me say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. If you've got a favorite time travel paradox you'd like to share, give us a call at 347-215-8972. Now, why don't you step us through the classic time travel paradox? What would that be?
Okay, I have myself a time machine, and I want to go meet my ancestors, okay? So I get in my time machine, I go back 100 years, and I meet my great-grandfather or whomever, and we're walking along together, and I don't know how, maybe I've got a weapon with me, and it accidentally goes off, and my grandfather is killed. Then there's this paradox. How am I ever born to go back in time to accidentally kill my grandfather in the first place? I mean, so... And does the universe explode from the, does it end the universe? Does it create some problem?
Does it end the universe? Does it just end you? You know, I mean, is it just that?
It seems to me that it's bigger than me because if I've created some sort of problem, some sort of loop that the universe can't get out of, it's like a record that's stuck in a groove. You know.
Right. Because let's follow through the logic. Okay, so you kill your great grandfather, therefore. Your grandfather's never born, therefore your father's never born, therefore you're never born, therefore you could not have come back and killed your great-grandfather.
Yeah, who was nevertheless dead right there in front. It's like, you know, Schrodinger's cat or something, but there's no way of resolving it. And so that's the problem. And of course, when it comes to time travel, then, you know, the Bible for time travel is, of course, the Back to the Future movies.
The Back to the Future films, absolutely. And I believe we have a clip that discusses a different kind of a paradox, actually.
You mean I'm going to see where I live? I'm going to see myself as an old man?
No, Marty, that could result in it. Oh, great Scott! Jennifer could conceivably encounter her future self. The consequences of that could be disastrous.
Doc, what do you mean?
I foresee two possibilities. One, coming face to face with herself 30 years older would put her into shock and she'd simply pass out. Or two, the encounter could create a time paradox, the result of which could cause a chain reaction that would unravel the very fabric of the space-time continuum and destroy the entire universe. Granted, that's a worst-case scenario. The destruction might, in fact, be very localized, limited to merely our own galaxy.
Well, that's a relief.
I love that. Well, that's a relief.
Well, that's a relief.
It's just
the galaxy that gets lost.
Yeah.
Christopher Lloyd is so great as that character, isn't he?
He owns that series of movies. It seemed like the first movie was really revolved around Marty, but by the end of the series, you realize that Doc Brown is the hero of the Back to the Future movies.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really all about him, the scientist who invents time travel. Absolutely. So there's the paradox. Let's unravel that one a little bit. Now, what's happening? So Marty's girlfriend, Jennifer.
Yeah, they've gone to the future, then, not the past. This time it's the future.
They've moved into the future.
Yeah, and the risk is that Jennifer is about to encounter old Jennifer. So that, and it's less of a paradox problem. It's not the grandfather paradox where you accidentally kill yourself. But it sort of is, because here's the loop, the possibility of a loop. You meet yourself in the future, because you get in your time machine, you go forward, and you meet old Phil, and I meet old Stephen, and right before you meet yourself, you have no memory of having met yourself before, okay?
Right.
And so when you meet yourself, all of a sudden you have a memory of meeting yourself, and then. In the future, the old Stephen all of a sudden has all these memories that, and could cause probably a mental loop, you know. But it would seem to me that problem would be localized to just that person. You know what I'm saying? And in the Back to the Future movies, that's exactly what happened. They did meet each other. They both passed out.
Right.
From the shock
they just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, they just couldn't deal with it, and they both pass out, and then, you know, the universe does not end. So,
What's interesting to me about that is that, it seems to me that that paradox is not as dangerous as the grandfather paradox. And,
right.
And the grandfather paradox makes certain assumptions about how time works, and the, we'll call it the Jennifer paradox, makes certain assumptions about how time travel works.
Right.
Neither of which necessarily have to be true. The grandfather paradox is going to assume that there is one timeline,
right,
and there is one universe, and if you mess with the integrity of that, bad things can happen.
That's right. And obviously the Back to the Future movies, it's sort of funny because the original Back to the Future movie acted as though there was one timeline. If you mess with it, you're going to remove yourself from existence. You remember the picture where they were slowly fading from existence? Because
sure.
He had messed something up. Well, then Back to the Future 2 and 3, he goes back in time and messes something up, and it just creates a new timeline rather than, you know, rather than there being a grandfather paradox, Biff becomes the ruler of the town or whatever. And
right.
And so you just created a new timeline instead of removing yourself from existence. So there's a little inconsistencies in those movies, but hey, they were more about having fun than anything else, I think.
Well, I think they definitely were. Although in the end, it was all about one consistent timeline. It seems like they had to get rid of that extra timeline. Certainly, the idea that you can just go spinning off infinite numbers of new timelines was not an idea that would have sat well with Doc Brown or with the Back to the Future universe generally. You know, it was like this is because otherwise it's like, well, okay, so the whole Biff thing only happened in a parallel universe. We'll just go back to the one that I came from, right? That didn't seem to be an option, right? It seemed like somehow we were still stuck with all that stuff happening, and we have to do something to correct it. As opposed to the idea that if you go back in time and kill your grandfather, all you've really done is you've moved into a separate parallel universe. That you'd still be there. In the universe you're in now, you would never be born. But that wouldn't preclude the fact that in the universe you came from, which would now be a completely separate place, you showed up and killed your great grandfather. And I think
at the very end of those movies, okay, the very last scene of Back to the Future 3, he shows up back in his 1985, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he crosses that ravine where they had put the bridge there. And there was a sign there. And what did the sign say about the ravine? It was Eastwood Ravine.
Eastwood Ravine, named after Martin.
Named after Martin.
Going by the name Clint Eastwood back in the Midwest, right.
That's right. So even the at the very end where he had fixed everything just about, there were still some things that had he had done that would have forever changed the timeline, even in small ways.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And
I don't know if there's a point there. It's just an entertainment, but I mean, yeah.
They're fun movies. I love those movies. I think the thing that's interesting about the Jennifer paradox, if we talk about that one for a minute, is that it assumes that time travel works in such a way that there's an assumption, okay, that Jennifer must have gotten back from the future, back to 1985, and grown up to become the old Jennifer.
Right.
Okay? Whereas really...
Had she gone forward in time and then showed up, she might have arrived in a future where they said, you know, I wonder what happened to that girl I went out with. You know, she disappeared back in 1985, and we hadn't seen her since. Yeah.
Well, look, here we are 30 years later, and here's a young woman who looks remarkably like her. It can't be her because she would be, a middle-aged woman by now. But that's actually what traveling into the future would bring. Absent also traveling back into the past, and that gets me to my my final answer to the what's the practical application of traveling back through time. Well, the big useful thing that you can do with traveling back through time is you can get back if you've traveled into the future.
That's right.
if you've moved into the future, then traveling back through time will allow you to come back into the present. Because actually, the truth is, traveling into the future is not only not precluded, it's something that scientists acknowledge we could do. There are ways that we could travel in the future. It would still take, by our current technological development level, fairly exotic solutions. But you can travel to the future by traveling very fast. If you travel fast enough, you experience something under, I think it's general relativity, called time dilation, which means that time will start traveling, passing more slowly for you than it is for the people who aren't moving at that speed, such that you might be traveling through space for a year or so, and you come back to Earth and hundreds of years may have passed. You have traveled into the future.
With no hope of getting back, though.
Well, without some technology for moving backwards in time, it's a one-way trip. That's the thing about traveling into the future. It can happen, but it's a one-way trip. I think the other way it can happen is very massive objects. It's interesting that both traveling into the future and traveling into the past have to do with the same basic premises. You travel really fast and you travel into the future. You travel fast enough and suddenly you go back into the past. Massive objects can actually warp space-time in such a way that you can experience that time dilation even without moving fast. So you could, for example, go hang out on the periphery of a black hole, not go in and get yourself crushed, but just be near it, and the proximity to that big massive object would actually put you into time dilation. And essentially the same thing that we just talked about happening if you travel near light speed would happen by being near the black hole, and you would experience time differently than people, and you would take that one-way trip into the future through doing that,
yeah.
as opposed to moving into the black hole if there's a wormhole in there and then maybe somehow being shot back through time, which is one of the other possible ways of getting of going backwards in time.
Well, I tell you, going backwards in time is an important thing. You asked me earlier, what would be so cool about the technology of going back in time? Well, here's the big deal. The technology to send you backwards in time is the same as the technology to travel faster than light. I submit it's the same technology. And,
okay.
You know, because in order to do either, it appears that you would need to have some sort of warping of space and some sort of passage between this place in space and that place in space. If you can do it to travel backwards in time, you could do it to get from here to some star system far, far away. And so if we're able to get time travel backwards in time, I think that faster than light travel comes along as a bonus, you know.
And this is the thing that never gets mentioned in Star Wars or Star Trek or name your favorite space opera where people habitually travel faster than light. Somehow that traveling faster than light should be perceived from some references as them moving back through time. But no one ever has to deal with any problems around that. Somehow in the Star Trek universe, they've learned how to warp space in such a way that you get to go faster than light, but time doesn't get messed up, right?
Right. I think even in Star Trek IV, where they go back in time to do the humpback whales or whatever, you know, they said, do the calculations for time warping, as if that somehow would be different from, you know, normal warp drive or whatever. And anyway, I think that traveling backwards in time and faster than light are very difficult problems, and they're really the same problem.
I think they probably are two sides of the same coin, and they may not be possible. We could find
that it's not possible, but hey, you know,
we could find, for example, that it's the anthropic principle in action. That time travel may be excluded because it would create maybe not the paradoxes, but so much confusion that life couldn't exist. I don't know if things could move randomly back and forth. Certainly, it needs to be hard. if you're going to have it at all. It needs to be something that doesn't happen all the time. You wouldn't want to just start accidentally moving backwards through time,
right,
or have that have that be something that just randomly happens in the universe. That would be very strange. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're coming up on our final segment here, and if you'd like to talk about time travel with us, you can reach us at 347-215-8972.
We need to apologize to our live audience for what happened last week. And
certainly do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the archive for last week's show sounds great. There's no problem. And when Phil and I were talking with our guests, we had a three-guest panel. So it was five of us total on the line. When we were talking to each other, we heard each other fine, and the archive sounds fine. But apparently our live listeners couldn't hear at all. And it was some issue with our host, I'm sure. And so for those who tried to hang in there, thank you. And we hope that you've listened to the program since then and have enjoyed it.
We appreciate our listeners hanging in. And in fact, apparently several of them in the chat room hung on right through the end of the show, even though they couldn't hear what was going on. So we've got real troopers for listeners. We really appreciate that. Now I was gonna mention a different movie, and I wonder if you've ever seen a movie called Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh yeah.
Okay, yeah. So this came out a little bit after Back to the Future, and it kind of a rip off on Back to the Future, but it did something profoundly different from Back to the Future, and I was thinking about this philosophically. Probably not in any other way, but philosophically, I think I like Peggy Sue Got Married better than I like Back to the Future, and I'll tell you why. In Back to the Future, the basic, and I'm talking just about the first movie, because it gets pretty complicated, as you were saying, once you start going into the Old West, and Biff builds the, you know, casino in honor of himself and all that stuff. It's great, but let's just compare those two movies.
Okay, the first one, Peggy Sue.
Yeah, in Back to the Future, Marty makes everything right in his parents' life by going back in time and having this influence on him and helping his dad to make decisions better. And suddenly he comes back to a present that is much improved because he's gone back and changed the past.
With the power of his own coolness.
It's the
ultimate teenage fantasy. I'll go back in time and straighten my parents out.
Exactly. I will go back in time and, with the power of my coolness, straighten my parents out and thus improve my life in the present.
I'm sure your daughter has thought this a million times, Phil.
If only she could. Yeah, she would. She would be all over that. She'd be in the DeLorean. In a New York.
In a heartbeat. Yeah,
absolutely. But contrast that with Peggy Sue Got Married. What happens in the end? And spoilers here, folks, okay? So go see Peggy Sue Got Married if you haven't, but I'm about to tell the end, okay? In Peggy Sue Got Married, she has the option of going back. She goes back and observes all these things that happen. She has the option of changing her life in lots of different ways. She cannot marry this guy, et cetera, et cetera. She can, you know, be a different person. She has all these choices. And in the end, she sees these pictures of her children, and she realizes, oh, no, I have to have the life I have because I value the life I have, and
yeah,
I don't
even,
want to
even
change.
With the, yeah, even with the all these, even with all the problems that I have in my future, including the potential of a divorce and all these other things, she still wants to keep the life she has. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think philosophically, that's where I am with time travel, because what Marty needed to do in a world without time travel. Let's just say Doc had, you know, stayed with his mind reading research rather than moving on to time travel.
I love that scene. I love that scene where he puts that plunger on his head.
I thought about us having that sound.
This damn thing doesn't work at all.
Yeah, I love that. That is so funny. If there was no option of going back to the past to change his situation, maybe he could have, in the present, had that kind of influence on his dad. And maybe there could have been some realization that, you know, your whole life isn't a waste, and you can make decisions now, and you can change things now. And we still have the option of moving towards a better future, even if there's nothing that we can do about our past, which is actually the situation that we're all really in, right?
Yeah.
So granted, it's not as much fun as a teenage fantasy, but the idea that, yeah, I'd like to go back and look at the past. That's a good thing that traveling back into the past would be for. But I don't want to change anything because I value what my life is now. And I recognize the fact that whether I go back and change the past or not, the future is still something that I can change. It's still something that I can make different if I need to make it different. And that's what I call, and I've not trademarked this or anything, but that's what I call practical time travel. And it's not moving any faster into the future than we were going to anyway, but it's moving into a future that we've picked. And it's
right.
It's moving into the future that we want, and that I think is not as exciting, but as profound an idea as even traveling back into the past.
Well, and it's also it's an important realization to and a grown-up realization to make that to a large extent. We are responsible for the lives that we have because of the decisions we've already made.
That's right.
And we are presently responsible for the lives that we will have in the future. And so, I see exactly where you're going with that, and I think it's a wise and good point. So, yeah, absolutely.
Wow, wise and good.
Yeah, exactly.
We might just shut it down after tonight.
it's not going to get any better than that, folks. That's about as good as we can.
Yeah, that's right. If I hit wise and good in the same night, I think we're pretty much done. Go ahead. What were you gonna
say? Maybe you want me to drop wise or good? We can go with just one or the other.
No. It's okay. No, we'll keep pushing.
Okay.
I could be wise and good and. I was listening to that interview we did with James Hughes a while back, and when we talked about how he in Change Surfer Radio, how he's got sexy in his tagline, and that we didn't figure we could pull that one off. So I got wise and good. I'll work towards sexy, okay? I still got something. So we've still got stuff we could shoot for, even if we've achieved wisdom and goodness by our own reckoning. I think. there are still things we can work towards.
Yes.
But what I was going to say is that's really what a big piece of what the Speculus is all about. It's all about these possible futures that we're looking at. We're looking at great stuff that could happen, and that we want to make happen. That we want to choose those futures. And that was what inspired me to link to the article from MIT News called Hope on the Horizon. Did you get a chance to look at that?
Oh, yeah. A great article. All our listeners, you got to get out and read this thing. I think we ought to go through it step by step, Phil, because everything that they talk about is stuff that is important and interesting. So,
yeah, let me set the stage for this. So,
okay.
The title was Hope on the Horizon. The subtitle, MIT Researchers Point to Potential Economy-Boosting Technologies. Now, what's important about this is that all the good news you're about to hear is really just limited to one area. It's just limited to, these are the technologies that are actually going to help improve the economy. If we were to look at all the new technologies that are in development that can bring about changes. This is just a tiny little subset, not only because of the particular subject matter, but just because the particular brilliant MIT people who happen to be on hand to answer the question are not everybody who's working on potential technologies that are going to boost the economy. So having limited it both of those ways, now let's talk about what some of these actually are. And I'll start with the first one, and that's bioengineering. This is tremendously important for the future of virtually just about everything.
Yeah.
Food production is fuel production. There's a number of things that that biotechnology, medicine, that it impacts. But from a standpoint of hitting the economy, absolutely, food production. It also stands to I'm sorry, I get excited about this. And bioengineering can do so much for us that it's hard to characterize it. And I'm aware of the time, so I know we want to hit all these. But
Phil, I don't think we should be worried about the time constraints. I think we ought to just hit all of these and you know, just take the time we need to, because this is just
time
too
be damned.
Cool. Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
We're the masters of time tonight.
So, that's right.
So, for one thing, okay, you can design biological organisms that will make it possible to make food grow in places that it won't. You can make food more nutritious than it is. All of these have tremendous economic benefits. You can make food that doesn't have the same kind of damaging effect on the environment. And if you go beyond food, we've been talking about the algae economy on the blog. Bioengineering is a huge piece of that, developing strains of algae or of other plants that might actually provide the fuel that we need to power our economy.
Right.
I was just reading Freeman Dyson's article on global warming, and one of the ideas he talks about in there is the bioengineered tree. He says that biotechnology, probably more than anything else, is the big hope for dealing with carbon in the atmosphere, because we can develop carbon eating trees that will solve the problem, and that's a few years down the road, but that's probably the quickest and easiest way to get to a non economically damaging solution to the problem of global warming. So bioengineering is a huge one, and I'll.
Well, I want to just throw this out real quick on algae. Why would algae be better? And let's say I can use algae to produce diesel fuel, all the diesel fuel the world needs, you know, indefinitely. Why is that a better solution than pumping crude out of the ground and making that into diesel? Because it would be carbon neutral. When you have algae and you get diesel from it, or gasoline or jet fuel, all of which is possible according to the research that they've got now, you just have used different algae strains for different sorts of fuel. They have to absorb CO2 in order to make the fuel. And so you're absorbing the CO2 in the creation of the fuel, and then the fuel releases the CO2 just like normal diesel does. But you're not pumping it out of the ground and releasing it into the atmosphere. You're taking it out of the atmosphere and releasing it back to the atmosphere. It's basically carbon neutral. And so that's another big plus, besides the whole issue of running out of oil in the ground. That's why algae is a huge growing our own fuel is a huge deal.
A huge deal economically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You take the next one.
Okay, biosolar cells. Okay, what we're talking about here is not the silicon cells that are looking better all the time. But we're talking about actually mimicking plants and their ability to harvest energy from sunlight. And why would you want to do that rather than build a silicon cell? Well, because it appears that plants get a lot more out of sunlight, and they are able to convert sunlight to energy so much more efficiently than our best silicon solar cells. And also, guess what? Plants self-assemble. And so you could, you know, what if we can mimic a plant's ability to self-assemble and then mimic its ability to convert sunlight to energy? That would be a huge breakthrough. So, yes, biosolar is going to be a big deal.
Big one. Digital fabrication is the next one. And,
now, Neil Gershenfield is the guy who brought this up. And I did a book review of his about a year ago. He had written Fab. And it's his big baby. I mean, he's all over digital fabrication, and the reason he sees, you know, this is a game changer.
Well, go ahead and tell why. Yeah, you're kind of our resident expert on Fab, since you've done interviews with some of the leading luminaries and have written book reviews on it, and you're kind of my go-to guy on Fab, I gotta say.
Okay.
So,
well, digital fabrication is not nanotech. I think that there's some confusion with some bloggers. I've read some blogs that they seem to get the two mixed up, like a nanofactory mixed up with digital fabrication. we've got digital fabrication right now. We don't have nanofactories, and we might not have nanofactories for a while, okay? But, I mean,
right.
I've seen advertised here recently a 3D printer that for, I think it was a couple $1,000s, and you just fill it up with cheap raw materials, like a, I think it was a polymer-type powder or whatever. But anyway, and it would assemble, you know, you could make a coffee cup or a toothbrush, or, you know, if you're able to embed electronics in there by also putting in, put in a metal as well, you could make an AM radio or whatever you wanted to make. You just need the plan on your computer. You could download, apparently, you know, once everybody is doing this, you could download it from the internet and then just print it out on your home fab lab or rapid prototype machine or 3D printer or whatever you want to call it.
And what we're going to see is digital production of goods, a digital revolution in the production of goods, similar to the digital revolution we've seen in the handling of information. It's the next step. So
right.
where all information down to, you know, movies and audio and print and everything has become digitized. Now we're going to see that same kind of huge change in terms of how physical goods are produced along those lines.
Can you imagine, for example, how neat it would be to do all your Christmas shopping from home? Go to Amazon.com, download. And information becomes really the only thing of value at that point. You know, raw materials would have some value still, but I mean, you'd put the raw materials in your machine, you'd download the plans for, you know, a teddy bear or whatever it is you wanted to print out for your kids. It's made in the machine, and you know, and there you go. You put it under the Christmas tree or whatever. That's, you know, that could be one way that this could go. So that's pretty interesting.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Digital fabrication. Education. Eric Klopfer talks about the need to embrace systems that emphasize and enhance certain characteristics, creativity, and the ability to solve problems being prime among those. And he talks about using games, media, collaboration, and social networking to improve how students are educated. And I think in addition to everything he points out here, I think MIT is a great place to talk about education because, you know, they have put virtually all of their courseware online for free. So you cannot become you can't get a degree. You can't get an MIT degree, but anybody in the world who has an internet connection can get an MIT education for free over the internet. And, you know, think what that must be potentially pumping into the economy just in terms of people's ability to access that information and to make good use of that information. It's an astounding thing that they've done in making that possible. I actually think it's kind of interesting that he doesn't even mention that.
Well, we really have no excuse for ignorance anymore.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're a person of average intelligence, there's not much in the way of information that you can't get within seconds. You know, I mean, if you and thanks to Google, thanks now to MIT and Wikipedia and all the a host of blogs, including we hope the Speculist. I mean,
absolutely.
You can learn lots and lots and lots of things, and there's no excuse for being ignorant. You can learn everything in the world is at your fingertips now, and so yeah, that's a cool thing.
Yeah, it still is going to, and for the foreseeable future, will cost money to become accredited, to get
right.
a degree. But the knowledge is there, and it's available in ways that it never has been before. It's really a very cool time to be somebody who wants to learn something because you've got options that people have never had before in human history in terms of being able to learn.
Okay,
electrochemical energy. Paula Hammond talks about that. Now, what's that one all about?
It's a branch of engineering that takes in lots of things. It includes silicon solar cells, advanced batteries, supercapacitors, all of which are going to be very, very important to, well, among other things, our future transportation infrastructure. That's to me. I think that the way we're going to be going in the future with getting around in this country is going to involve plug-in hybrids, and that we're going to need. We're going to need better battery technology. Solar cells could be an important part of this, and supercapacitors, which you don't hear as much about, could be a very important part of this. And why is that? Because supercapacitors can be charged almost immediately, and they don't have some of the same problems that batteries have, the battery memory problems and things like that. They can be charged a jillion times, and they don't ever wear out, things like that. So, that's that branch of science that deals with that, and she's saying, yeah, that's going to be an important part of our future. There's going to be breakthroughs there, and, yeah, I agree with her. It's a
big enabling technology for a lot of the cool stuff that we're going to be able to do.
If you're interested in that kind of thing, you can't go a single day without hearing a breakthrough in either solar cells, batteries, or supercapacitors. I see it every single day, something new happening in those fields. So.
Yeah, there's an awful lot going on, and I think we're headed towards probably some major new developments in all of those areas. It's really exciting stuff. Now the next one is embedded electronics, and Michael Strano. I'm just going to read this one because I just think it's short and it's just very cool. One transformation on the near-term horizon is the embedding of low-cost electronics into almost every object that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. You know, just to stop for a second, that's happening as we speak. I mean, you think about how much more electronics there are in your day-to-day life now than there were 10 years ago or 10 years before that, right? It's really
right.
It's amazing to consider it.
I'm going to just throw this out right now. When you walk around, just walking around, do you have a computer on you of some sort at all times now, Phil?
Of course. I got my phone. It's
yeah.
a computer.
Yep.
Yeah.
That,
I mean,
yeah. It's a computer.
If nothing else, I've got that with me. And usually when I'm at a workplace, I usually have a couple of computers going. When I work from my home office, I've got my work laptop and I've got my personal laptop. I've got my phone. Then I've got my wife's computer right over here that I use that sometimes too. It's amazing how much of this technology surrounds us and informs our lives. We watch TV. I had downloaded a bunch of episodes of Battlestar Galactica and we were watching them on TV. And it's like I'm uploading. Information off the internet onto my computer. Then I take the computer over and I hook it to my DVD player, and I'm running it through the DVD player onto the TV. And I'm thinking about, this is pretty bizarre that it's come to this. And half the time I don't even do it that way. I do it with my iPod. I just run the iPod directly into the TV. And I'm sorry, that's a bit of a digression, but yeah, bottom line.
Not at all. It's just an example of where we're going.
We're just immersed in electronics technology all the time.
Yeah, I think that what we're looking towards is ubiquitous computing, where literally every device that you have, every physical object in your life is smart.
Right.
You don't have car keys anymore. Because there's maybe an RF tag or something on your clothing or something that identifies you as you walk towards your car, and it opens the door and cranks the engine for you.
Exactly.
In my cases, my eyeglasses would probably become a cell phone and internet access at the same time. On and on and on.
You'll probably have some kind of nano correction contact lenses anyway. But
that's true. I'm thinking near term. My eyeglasses might be an internet connection in 2 or 3 years.
Well, in fact, one of the things Strano says is a pair of sunglasses. He uses sunglasses, but it could easily be
corrected
any
yeah.
optical device. Yeah, corrected vision may have the ability to project a visual display accessing the internet, have an embedded mm-hmm. cell phone, and actuate other devices as one glances at them. He says the technology already exists. And then he talks about flexible electronic paper and electronic clothing will change the way – there's your RF tag, right, in the electronic clothing. Change the way information is projected and harnessed at a personal level. Everyday objects may sense, detect, and constantly adjust to our environment, controlling temperature, lighting, noise level, et cetera. And The other one I'll add, because it actually is good for the economy, although people might find it annoying, is that this level of interconnectedness with electronics will mean that we will be marketed to in ways that we can't even begin to imagine right now.
Hopefully in ways that will actually be useful. I would rather get a marketing message for a product that I might actually want to buy, rather than just randomly spammed, which might actually be a useful thing. But anyway, this is Moore's Law endgame. You know, I mean, this is what happens when circuits get smaller and smaller and cheaper, that eventually they might actually disappear from sight, but are present everywhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, our next one is fusion, and we've spoken about fusion so many times on this program, actually. Some of these topics we write about on the blog quite a bit, but fusion is actually one we've talked about quite a bit.
Right.
What
I thought was interesting about this was it says, you know, like we've mentioned many times on this show and elsewhere, that fusion is a long-term thing. And once we get it, it'll be, you know, I mean, once you have it, that's wonderful, because you'll have all the energy you need, basically, right?
Exactly.
But on our way to getting it, this is something I'd never thought about. On our way to getting it, there's going to be some dividends from the research, and one of them was what we can do with plasma fields once we understand and are able to harness those. And that's something we have to do in order to get to the fusion reactors. And so I thought that was interesting.
Very interesting. What can we do with plasma fields?
They said convert most waste to fuel. Mr. Fusion?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Instead of Mr. Fusion, maybe they should call it Mr. Plasma, because a device with plasma apparently could any waste product it could be converted to fuel, and so that would be a pretty neat thing, even if fusion is a long way off in the future. Maybe we can have that soon. That would be cool. So,
that would be very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one is life extension. And
another topic we've talked a lot about.
We have talked a lot about this one. To talk about how life extension improves the economy. That's interesting, because people always want to give the bad side of life extension, how it's going to cause overpopulation and it's going to cheat people out of taking their own place in the world.
A lot of people have the idea that, you know, you're going to extend feeble life, or life that, you know, instead of living in the nursing home for 6 months or a year, you live in the nursing home for forever. No, that's not what life extension is about. Life extension would be about prolonging healthy life, because you can't really prolong unhealthy life, because being unhealthy is a dangerous way to be, and it causes death soon. You know, it's just the way
it is.
In fact,
that's what our current medical infrastructure is doing.
Yeah.
That's what we're set up to do right now, is to prolong unhealthy life for as long as possible. And life extension is really almost the opposite of that. It's saying, maintaining not only making people live longer, but making them young longer, making vital, healthy life go on, working towards what Aubrey de Grey talks about, indefinitely.
Right.
And the economic benefit of that, actually, is that you don't have this notion of people dropping out of the economy. You don't have this idea of, well, I'm old now and I have to stop working. Instead, you have people moving on to more interesting things. You have these creative, engaged people with a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge continuing to be engaged in the economy and bringing new solutions to problems, because they know how to do stuff. And
right.
They haven't gotten feeble and had to, you know, go, you know, play shuffleboard or something like that. They want to continue to be involved in what's happening in the world, and are able to do that because they're physically able to do that. I mean, retirement, really, the idea of it comes from sort of a, well, it's what you do right before you die. I mean, that's originally, they had people retire at 65 back when people were expected to live to be about 62, right?
Right, right.
there
if you got lucky, you lived to be 65, but didn't live much longer, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The idea that people would spend years of leisure as their health slowly failed wasn't really what was designed, but people's lives have gotten longer in the meantime, and that sort of happened as a matter of course. But if you take that to the next step, you say, no, we're going to make life last indefinitely long, and people are going to have indefinitely long, healthy lives, then that whole model is eliminated, and instead you have this model where people are productive and they're continuing to make important things happen throughout that entire time that they're with us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the next one on the list here is mitigating autism, I'm not sure how that would economically hit us that hard. I mean, apparently now it's like 1 in 150 children, is it something like that, have some form of autism?
I think that's what I said, yeah. Yeah, I think the big economic boon here is the incredible cost that's being sunk into dealing with it now.
Right.
There's almost this. And, you know, PJ Manny talked about this when we had her on the program once. She was talking about this, almost this epidemic of autism that, you know, putting aside the personal and psychological and emotional strain of that, you know, it's taken a huge economic toll.
Right.
So, you know, if we're talking about things that are going to have a big economic benefit, this is one that actually will, because right now it's taking a huge economic toll for people to have to deal with it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think that it certainly is the moral and humane thing, obviously, to do. If there's something we can do to help these children and these people who are autistic, absolutely, let's do it. I was just questioning how big of an economic impact that would have by comparison to some of these other things, but it's it's something that PJ Manny mentioned, that some of the people that contribute the most, I mean, have a form of autism. I'm talking Asperger's syndrome. Am I pronouncing it right?
I think so. Yeah.
I'm close. Anyway, it's basically, you know, people that are maybe a bit nerdy, you know, that have some social problems, but are extremely talented when it comes to things like mathematics and science and things like that. And so, there are some things that maybe some forms of autism, maybe we don't want to mitigate. Maybe it should be up to the, if it's an adult especially, that has benefit of perhaps their brain being wired slightly different, maybe they don't want to change. So maybe it's up to them, and forms of autism that are like that. But it's an interesting, it'll be an interesting ethical field to look at.
A big conundrum that we're going to have to deal with in the future.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, as we try to figure this out, and that's part of the
maybe some of us will choose to be autistic part of the time, and then, you know, and then turn it off when we're ready to have a social life. I don't know.
Well, I think a lot of us do that.
When I'm saying autistic, I'm talking, you know, gifted mathematically. I'm not talking locked up like some these poor children are. That they are.
Sure, but shut down some of your social interaction skills in favor of other functioning of the brain. You know, we might actually see that sort of thing be possible with technologies that are being developed now, but I think swinging it back around to economic benefit, that's one of the reasons probably that there is a multiplying effect in helping people who really are debilitated by autism, because they're almost always the really smart people. So
yeah.
It's like, well, if you can bring the smart people back into the fold, there's a big economic benefit to that too.
Absolutely.
These are people who have an awful lot to contribute. But you're right. It's not an easy. It's like time travel. It's a tough nut to crack, actually, when you start talking about autism. It's a very complex issue. One that probably deserves more attention than we're able to give it tonight. Okay. The next one is problem solving, And Ed Boyden asks this question: why are we so bad at anticipating, deciding, and acting upon the prevention of problems in the future? One possibility is that we need to use our knowledge of the mind to engineer better information handling tools and software for visualizing, understanding, and figuring out how to fix problems. And we need to understand data and deal with problems at a higher level. Information by itself is not enough. Well, I agree with his conclusion there that information by itself is not enough, but I would actually disagree with his premise. I don't think we're bad at solving problems at all. My speculist manifesto is that that's what we've evolved to do, is that we're really good at solving problems.
What is he comparing us to? What entities is he thinking that, you know, that humans are not measuring up to?
I think he's comparing us to how we should be. I think what we've got here is the good is the enemy of the perfect, right?
And
it's easy to get into that mindset, but I think we're darn good at solving problems.
Right.
In fact, we're too good at solving problems. We're so good at solving problems that we tend to see the world as a problem, as opposed to recognizing opportunities to enhance our situation that don't have anything to do with fixing something that's wrong, but then instead have to do with just taking advantage of good things that are out there for us to get a hold of.
One thing we really are bad at is appreciating how far we've come, and so sometimes we tend to get down on ourselves as a species or as a society or whatever because we don't appreciate how far we've come, and so that's kind of part of what we address here at the Speculus, isn't it? So
absolutely.
I think maybe the answer to this is we can improve ourselves eventually, and that we're talking about coming up with greater than human intelligence, which is something we talk about a lot, and either through augmenting humans or through artificial general intelligence, and we could become better problem solvers that way. He's talking about the singularity, it seems to me.
I wonder if he's not. I think he's talking about us solving problems before they become problems.
Yes.
I think his objection is we wait until they get really bad and then we do something about them. But my argument is we're probably
that's
trying to solve something else until it gets painful enough that's the one we have to focus on. You know.
That's right. And we have enough problems for today. You know.
It would seem.
Yeah, so there's a little more goodness and wisdom there. Just throw that into the program right there.
Oh, yeah, there you go. A little more goodness and wisdom. As we have decided that we have both qualities, goodness and wisdom.
That's right. We're self-selecting for that. But anyway, right. the next thing
What's
is
that?
Robots. Robots is one of those things that complete science fiction 5 years ago, just about. Okay?
Yep.
Now they're everywhere. They're very simple robots. You know, you got the Roombas that are vacuuming our floors, and you got some soldier robots that are really just, for the most part, remote-controlled vehicles with guns on them over in Iraq, and you got some unmanned aerial vehicles that are also fighting the war on terror and things like that. But these things are coming along very quickly, it seems to me, and what is it, Rosie from the Jetsons? Is that the name of that robot? I think
yeah,
she's
Rosie.
Not, is that her? She's not. I would say she's. She seems a lot closer now than I would have guessed that she would have been. Just a few years ago. It seems
well.
Like,
you know what? She won't. She won't have. I don't think she'll have rivets showing unless it's a design
unless
element.
Want them,
won't be
ma- unless we
yeah,
want
she won't
them
be made
to
of metal.
Yeah.
And I don't see why she'd need to wear an apron. But the truth is that in Japan right now they're seriously planning on having this overwhelming surge in old age in their population curve dealt with by robots. They are
right.
Looking to robots to be caregivers for their aging population, and they're completely serious about it. And one of the reasons they're one of the drivers behind robotic technology right now is they plan to have them. I mean, they plan to have robots in the home helping to take care of people, actually helping to maintain a lot of the quality of life type stuff that Rosie would have been responsible for.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And so they're pushing it hard, and in many ways Japan has taken the lead on that, but we'll see. This is gonna be interesting. Yeah,
well,
it seems like Rosie's gonna be made out of plastic, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think she'll be fantastic. And probably won't wear an apron. But Brooke says that this is the lead-up to a classic hockey stick growth curve. So anything we've seen in robotics in the last few years, just never mind. It's going to be much bigger in the next five. Much, much bigger. So.
Well, I think we need to stop there, Phil, because our final song is actually a kind of a lengthy one, and so for benefit of our audience to be able to hear the entire song, we probably should cut it off there.
Okay. Well, let me just say, sustainable cities. We did a thing about a big building slash potentially self-contained city earlier this week. Transcending technology. Heck, we talk about that every week on The Specula. So there, I dealt with it.
You finished it up. You finished it up.
Yeah, you got us into this mess, and I got us out, Steve.
No doubt.
So what's the song?
The band is Wake of the Titan, and the song is Good Night, Cold Earth. And it's a little bit dystopic, but have a listen to it. I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to listening to that. And, Stephen, hope you enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.
You too,
thanks.
Phil.
All right. Thanks to all those who listened in with us. We look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.